Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with filmmakers Mick Davis and Matthew Yerby. That's coming up on Endeavors. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. I know, it's the middle of the week. What's going on? I've got two shows this week. I'm actually back in a space where I have content, and it does feel good to kind of get back into that space that I had left for a little bit. Speaking of content creation, as much as I have mixed emotions about that term, I'm toying with the idea of maybe putting a little snippet, little clips of my interviews up on both YouTube and TikTok. Of course, I have to let you know the publicists and you know the middlemen who get me the interviews know, so that I'm not you know, doing anything without consent or anything like that. But people are telling me it's a good idea to at least perhaps try it, so that might be a thing that we do in the future. And it won't be full shows, you know, but it'll be like maybe one question, or you know, maybe just a clip of them talking about something. So it won't happen right away. I kind of want to test it out first and see how it goes. But you know, maybe in the new year, I'm going to revamp a lot of things. So that could be one thing that happens. Today's show is kind of interesting, and I'm calling it the Shane West duology. Shane West, of course, being a great actor. Now, I don't actually interview Shane West. He is not on the show. But I'm speaking with two film directors, Mick Davis and Matthew Yerby, and Shane West is in both of their films, and they're sort of coming out around the same time, which can happen to actors time and time again. So I just thought it was kind of a funny little coincidence. So just a little special homage to Shane West in today's show. And my first guest is a wonderful Scottish filmmaker, writer and director. He has worked on such films as Modigliani, Haunting, Charles Manson, The Poison Child, and My Dad's Christmas Date, and has worked as a producer on the TV show 11th Hour and The Saint. He, and his new film, is a great film called Walden, starring Emile Hirsch, the aforementioned Shane West, and Kelly Garner. And it follows an unassuming court stenographer in a small southern town who, when he discovers he is dying, decides to exact revenge on criminals who escape the prosecution. And if you see the poster for the film, you're gonna get Dexter vibes, and we talked to Mick about that. It's also kind of a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde as well. So it's actually I think it's a really well written story, you know, tonally especially, and the performances from Emile Hirsch And actually David Keith, who I've long admired, who plays the judge in this film, are just have the right amount of what you need. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Mick Davis.
I'm going to record on my end as a backup. You have 20 minutes.
Perfect. Thank you. Mick Davis, hello. How are you today?
I'm good, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. So, Walden.
Yes, Walden.
This is a very interesting film. I had the chance to watch it. What made you, first of all, I think the choice of a stenographer is interesting because they're like kind of the one person that sees everything that goes on in the courtroom. What made you want to look at that profession and decide to create a movie around it?
I think it's probably throughout the years, the idea just festered in my mind because whenever I watched a courtroom drama, you would get all the excitement going on and all the energy going on. But then there's someone sitting right there in the middle, watching everything, recording everything, and without a flinch or speaking a word, packing up and going home. And I thought, that's an interesting person. And then when I watched the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, once again, everybody's watching Johnny or Amber, but nobody's paying attention to the stenographer. And I thought, now that's the ghost of the courtroom. What does she think of this case? And does she go home at the end of the day and put on a costume, jump off a building and save people's lives, you know?
Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously, this film deals with, like, you know, some murder and vigilantism. And obviously, the story is fictional. But how do you go about researching something like that?
Well, the research was mainly the stenographer side of it, you know, getting it right for Emile, the behavior in the courtroom of the stenographer. These little things were the important aspects of it. But to be honest, the rest of it was just, I wanted to create a backdrop of a small town in the Deep South that seemed a little trapped in time, could be To Kill a Mockingbird, that could be Gone with the Wind almost. It had that vibe that the pace of life had slowed down. And then front and center of it, coming out of the sort of the blandness of what's going on, would be this character. And then the rest was for good or for bad, my imagination, you know, and the progression of it.
And the character of Walden, played by Emile, he does speak in a very, like, he has very specific speech patterns and very specific mannerisms. Mm-hmm. How much of that was written into the script and how much of that came out of conversations you and Emile would have had?
I think you could probably say it was like almost like a 50-50 in a sense, because I'd written a character. My idea was Walden was a Pillsbury doorman with a bow tie. And if you prodded his tummy, he would chuckle or smile and was friendly and lovable. And everybody would want to cuddle this guy or wrap their arm around him because they felt he was lonely, that nobody cared about him. And all those things about somebody in life that sadly becomes insignificant to the rest of us. And and then, of course, the dialogue itself, the way it's written, I had to try and capture the Southern accent and try and put in a command of the English language for Emile that you just wouldn't get in a metropolis or in a Gotham somewhere. You just wouldn't get it. And show his intellect and even some of the people around him. So, and then Emile, when we met, said to me, you know what? I know this guy. I know who this guy is. And so when he arrived, we discussed, of course, he had to do it in the Southern accent. And when he arrived to shoot, it was perfect. And so he would read the dialogue as is written, and he delivered it exactly as I had imagined Walden to be.
You know, you were, when you were talking about small town, you were talking about vibes earlier. And for whatever reason, one of the vibes I got is the from the TV show Dexter.
Yes. With,
I'm curious as if that, like, if there was any inspiration from that at all, because I do see some of the similarities.
Well, I loved Dexter, didn't we all? Dexter was a compelling show to watch. I don't know if Dexter creeped in, may have done in my subconscious. I don't know. I think little things like the movie Misery,
yep,
creeped in a little bit, you know, and there's a few others, a composite really, you know. So if people say that it's a little bit Dexter, I take that as a compliment. I like the idea that Walden stands on his own as a character, because he has traits that Dexter did not have, because Dexter had a little bit of cynicism about him, a little bit of sarcasm about him, still endearing and still very lovable. But I just wanted Walden to be someone who, you know, you'd put him on your Christmas tree, you know?
Yeah.
Because he was so cuddly. So if there's a little bit of Dexter, residual Dexter in there, then I'll take that, you know, I'll take that as a compliment. Yeah.
The other thing that struck me is, you know, how we see sort of the two sides of all, and it's a little bit Jekyll and Hyde, or as the Scots would say, Jekyll and Hyde. How much of that do you think consciously or unconsciously came into the story?
Well, you know what? That's a great, great example, because I, having read Stevenson's book a few times in my life, especially at school, I loved the Jekyll and Hyde concept. I'd love to do a movie about Jekyll and Hyde. And that's exactly what it is. It's someone who can't take anymore. There was a movie Michael Douglas did years ago called Falling Down, where his character is a quiet, insignificant, coming home, gets caught in a traffic jam and transforms into a killer or whatever. And I did not want this to happen to Walden. I wanted Walden to have a love story and live happily ever after. But things happened. Walden then transforms, but he finds it so easy to slip back to his, you know, Dr. Jekyll side, which is, you know, the loving, caring Pillsbury Doe, full of humility, opens the door for a lady, and always stands up when a lady enters the room. But then there's something about him which no one could second guess.
You know, and he becomes this other person when he starts drinking, and it, you know, got me thinking. There's the term liquid courage, but why do you think so many of us are such different people when we're under the influence of something, whether it's alcohol or a controlled substance or even prescription medication? Where do you think that comes from?
I'm not a doctor or a psychologist, but I would say, just observing life, that people want to lose themselves in something else. I think people who manage to drink socially and curtail it, God bless them. I think there are people who lose themselves in it, and I know a few, we all know a few, or substances, whatever. And I think there's pain inside them, and the pain is trying to find a way out. And it may find a way out in a quiet room with a few beers, and then the next morning they wake up and get back to who they are. But ultimately, for that few hours, I think that all that pain, when it surfaces, can either manifest in just conversation with oneself, or listening to a Bob Dylan album, or going out and doing something awful. And that's the sadness of it all. I mean, Jekyll and Hyde is a book about alcoholism. It's not a book about evil. It's a book about someone who gets drunk and does things. And it became that story. So, you know, even although with Walden, without giving anything away, he's not a drinker per se, but he's trying to, actually, I think people drink thinking they will suppress the pain, but what happens is that it's the opposite effect. The pain then comes up and terrible things happen. So that's, I think, my take on how people deal with sadly, booze and everything else.
And I'm curious about the name Walden, because I think it actually fits the character really, really well, but it's not, you know, a common name. You know, it's not like George or Joe or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm curious where that came from for you, and is it a reference to Thoreau at all?
Well, everybody's asked me if it's Thoreau, but sadly it's not. You know, for me, it was just, I needed a name that fit a Pillsbury Doe kind of stenographer. And I rummaged through my brain, and sometimes you're lucky and you come up with a name. And Walden just seemed perfect. And the name, his surname, Dean, came from James Dean, because I'm a huge James Dean fan. And so I thought, I'll give him Walden Dean, because it seemed like an easy name. I mean, it seemed like a T-shirt name to me, you know. Walden Dean is cool. Walden Dean is Steno. Walden Dean is, you know, I wanted to try and turn the word Steno into like a Waldenism, you know. So Walden was just I'd love to give you something fantastical about how I came up with it, but it was just one of those. And I thought, he's after I'd written the first few pages, I thought, this guy is Walden.
You mentioned in sort of the writing and in the conversations you had with Emil, but for you, how different would you say, you know, you've written the first couple drafts, you have the story, and then you actually go and shoot it and film it. How similar or different was the script, and how similar or different did it get between those two periods of time, would you say?
Actually, what happened, because everything happened pretty quickly with this production, because my producers listened to my madness, my take on what I wanted to, because they said, what do you want to do? And I said, a movie about a stenographer. And they looked at each other as if to say, maybe this was a bad idea. And then I described what happens to my stenographer, and that piqued their interest. And so as soon as I commenced script, to be honest with you, the first draft came out pretty good. You know, and a lot of writers will tell you that they often go back to their first draft for inspiration. So the first draft was pretty good. There was a couple of changes, but I don't think we went beyond the second draft. We never went into many colors on this script, because what we would do is on set, Emil would come up with an idea to amplify or to expand on something. He would say, how about if I said this along with this? And I would listen to it. And if it was great, I'd go, yeah, absolutely. So maybe, you know, we'd do a cue card just to help that process. But there wasn't a great deal of rewriting, as it were, because I'd had such a good idea of how the journey would be on this thing that I was pretty anchored in that sense. So we never had to go, you know, like 10 versions of the script, you know.
In a way, this film deals with vigilantism, and there's a lot of conversations now in the zeitgeist about the morality of something like that, especially when it comes to, you know, they do it because they felt law enforcement didn't get it right. Have you thought about that issue and the morality of it all while making this?
Absolutely. I think that for me, you know, it's a tough word for me to use to describe him, but I guess it does apply. There's a lot of words do apply. I think it was for me that there are so many people in the world who watch what's going on, and they see loved ones, or they may walk down the street and see someone across the street being beaten up or whatever. Most of the time, people pull their phones out and film it. They don't go and help. They just film it. And then you'll hear them saying, oh, my God, look at that, look at that. But no one actually helps. And that, for me, is almost immoral. And, you know, law enforcement does the best that it can. with the limited resources that they have, because we're such a populated world now. And when you put that up against what we have available in law enforcement, it's almost an insurmountable Everest for a guy with a badge. And it's not that you have to send Batman out there to help, you know, balance the books, but it was a case of someone somewhere who decides that they're a lost cause in life, and therefore maybe they can do something for the less fortunate before they go out. And so for them, they see a warped version of morality in that. And I think that's how it applies for me. But it is immoral to go out and be a vigilante. It is immoral to go out and hurt people because they hurt someone else. But the sad fact is that, you know, the law enforcement do miss a lot of things and put a lot of criminals back on the street and a lot of sick individuals back on the street. And I just wanted to deal with sick individuals in this movie. I didn't want to deal with a gray area of a guy who stole a loaf of bread or something like that. That's not where I'm at. This is not Jean Valjean, you know?
So then, you know, on that note, and this is always, in you know, difficult to ask artists this, but for you, is there a specific message you think you're trying to get across, or do you just want people to enjoy the film for being a piece of art?
It's a really good question. I want, and thanks for calling it a piece of art. That's very nice of you. I think that for me, primarily what I want people to do is just enjoy the movie, first of all. Enjoy the ride, maybe get into the character. I'd like them to walk out of the theater asking, did I love Walden or should I hate Walden? You know, I want that in them. And the message in itself, I don't want to be pompous to think that I'm going to put a message out with a movie. I think for me, it was just simply a case of, you know, let's, if anything, and I'm not being New Testament about this, but let's, if we see something bad happen, put your phone down and try and help people, you know, and don't turn your back on, you know, the less fortunate, because there are so many people that we see every day in life who get the raw end of the stick, and people just don't care. So I wanted to create a little guy who is insignificant. He's not Chris Evans. He's not Hugh Jackman. He's just a Pillsbury Doe guy who wants to help people, you know.
Walden starts his actions because he believes that he's dying. Did that make you think about your morality at all and what you would do if you found out you were dying?
Another good question. What Walden suffers from, without giving away to the audience, one of my best friends, in fact, my best friend in Scotland, had the same scenario going back 10 years ago, and he's actually still around, which is great. So that inspired that part of the script. As far as what would I do if I got the word tomorrow that I was going out, I think, first of all, I'd be feeling really sorry for myself. And then I would think, okay, so is it worth sitting down and watching The Godfather again, which is my favorite movie? Will I get anything from it? Or do I go party? Or what do I do? Or do I go out and save lives? I don't think I'd like to save lives, but I don't think I have any Waldenisms in me. I think really it does make you ask the question. I think that's actually a really good point. First time I've thought of it. It does make you ask the question, what would be my behavior after finding out that I'm going out? If somebody says you've got a week, and we've seen movies that deal with it, what would you do? And so my version was Walden. What would Mick Davis do? I have no idea. I'd probably hide somewhere like an elephant in a room and not want to see, you know, want to see people I love, because that's a terrible thing. When you love people, you're going to miss them. And the idea of missing people is a heartbreaker for me, you know.
this film has so many moments and so many beautifully nuanced scenes. I'm curious for you, when making it, was there one scene or sort of one moment, one day of filming that you really enjoyed or that just really stuck out to you?
Oh gosh, I got to say to you, there were so many, especially the scenes between Kelly and Walden, the love interest in it. I thought their elevator scene, I thought, was really beautiful. And it's a funny story about that one, because on that day of shooting, that scene was supposed to be a flatbed, car on a flatbed, and driving through the streets and have the conversation in a car. And then we were in the building where we were shooting the steno competition, and I saw the elevator and I thought to myself, no, I'm going to take it out of the car and put it in the elevator, have him squeezed into the corner and have her impose herself on him. And that claustrophobia will really create something beautiful. And it did. That, and I think, without giving anything away, the scene between him and the judge towards the end of the movie. And I had to shoot that from a van because I had COVID. And so I'd spent the day inside the van with my I called them my baby monitors, and giving instructions to the actors because I couldn't go inside. So, but as I was watching it, I got to watch it as almost objectively, almost like an audience member. And I was so thrilled by what I was seeing. There were times I just never called cut. And that's, I do that sometimes. I let things run just in case the actors, good actors, will give you something extra. You get a little bit of gold. So those were the two moments, I think, for me in the movie that were beautiful.
Well, it is a very beautiful film, and it's Walden, and it opens in select theaters on November 10th, and then it will be on demand and digital on December the 12th. Mick Davis, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Oh, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
No worries. Have a good day.
All right. All the best. Peace, man.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Have a
good one.
Cheers.
Once again, that was my conversation with filmmaker Mick Davis. He is the writer-director behind Walden, which releases in select theaters Friday, November 10th, and it will be on demand and on digital starting December 12th. Well, from one Shane West movie to another, this time it is the Dirty South, written and directed by Matthew Yerby. This also takes place in a small town and follows when the small town big shot goes after the deed to her family farm. A heartbreaking bartender goes to extreme measures to save it. And it's written and directed by Matthew Yerby, who, in addition to being a writer and director, has also done some acting as well. This film is sort of his first feature as writer and director, and it's a good one. And of course, I mentioned Shane West, but it also stars Willa Holland and the great and underrated actor, Dermot Mulroney. The PR team from the Dirty South did want me to pass along the note that the Dirty South does have an interim agreement from ACTRA, as it is being released by Cineverse, an independent, non-AMPT affiliated distributor. So that means that under the terms, members may work on those productions without being in violation of the strike order per guild rules. So, so there is no violation of the strike happening on a lot of these smaller films. And that's also why you're seeing directors talk about the film rather than actors, because the directors aren't part of the union that's on strike. And so sometimes if you're under contract, part of the contract is doing publicity. So if an actor does publicity for a film, it would be in violation of the strike order. So that's why you're seeing a lot of directors doing this. And in this case, Matthew Yerby is the director, but this film also has an interim agreement from SAG-AFTRA. So the team just wanted, the team from KWPR just wanted me to pass that along. And without further ado, this is my conversation with Matthew Yerby. Matthew Yerby, hello, how are we today?
How you doing, Dan? I'm doing well.
Doing good, doing good. You have a new movie out, Dirty South, which has a lot of different moving parts and intriguing plot lines. For you, was there one thing that was sort of the genesis of this story, if you will?
Absolutely, yeah, that's great, because it all started with truly the characters. Usually I have a plot line first, but this one was different because I started with the characters. There's two songs that are from the 1960s. They were my father's favorite songs. And I listened to his music a lot after he passed away in 2017. And these songs were Runaround Sue and The Wanderer. Runaround Sue is about a girl who breaks everybody's heart. And The Wonder is about a guy that roams from town to town in his car. He's got two fists of iron and he can get any woman he wants. So I thought of a great idea. It's like, what happens when the girl that breaks everybody's heart meets the guy that can get any girl he wants? And so through that, I started making a story. It's like, why does she break hearts? And so she doesn't have any time. Anytime that a girl doesn't have time for you, there's a lot of guys that want her. And anytime, and so what makes this man wonder? And I created the backstory that is present in the film. And so the only thing that actually happened from there was my mentor told me 5 years ago to write what I know and write what I can produce. And so I chose Natchitoches, Louisiana, where I'm from, and I created a story that would display small town Southern life and actually just show the way that, you know, the way that people actually do down here.
You know, it's interesting. We see a lot of films set in small towns, but it strikes me that more often than not, it's maybe the Midwest or, you know, the coast. But Louisiana, I think, is a very underrated state in terms of its culture.
Absolutely.
Apart from being from there, what did you like about setting a film in that state? What is it about Louisiana that makes it rich for a story?
Well, I can tell you what's helped me the most was, one is the hospitality. The people in Louisiana, you know, they don't get films very often, so this is like magic to them. So that was the greatest thing that I learned throughout this film, was that there are so many people willing to help you if you just ask. And that's all I had to do, is just ask. It sounds easy, but like, it does take, you know, nobody likes to ask for anything, but I was very surprised to see that as soon as I did, people were ready to help. Louisiana also offers something, just, they have a beautiful landscape. It can be shot as farmland. You can shoot the swamps. You can shoot the ocean. You can shoot a city in New Orleans. And it is so much cheaper to shoot in Louisiana than most states.
You mentioned the song Runaround Sue, and for a protagonist, I think Sue is a very interesting name, because you sort of in the
cultural zeitgeist, Sue or Mary Sue is sort of this you know, plain girl who doesn't really have any skills, and that's clearly not the character with or that's clearly not the case with Willa's character in this piece. Was that conscious at all, that you sort of wanted to turn the idea of that character on its head a little bit?
Well, I mean, as far as consciously, I don't think I did. But, you know, I do, like, I named her Sue, and the plane does actually still show throughout the film because, you know, Sue, my character, comes from the other side of the track. She doesn't come from money, doesn't come from, every advantage that most people have. And so she doesn't have makeup. She throws her hair up in a, ponytail most days, and she doesn't have a lot of time. So there's not a lot of self-care.
Now, I know you have also done a little bit of acting. You have some acting background, and I'm curious how that affects your relationship with the cast as a director, knowing that you've sort of been in their place maybe more so than some other directors.
Absolutely. I approached this film as a actor's director because I told every one of them that this script is not the building, it's just the blueprint, and the first take is yours, the second one's mine. I did not want to put a roof on any of these actors to think that they were in a box where they could not express their artistry. And so I found every way that I could to actually encourage them to bring what you have to the table on the first one.
On that note, then, if the script was just a blueprint, are you the type of director that allows for improvisation in certain circumstances?
Absolutely. I believe that when actors are improvising, they're really listening to each other, because what they know is what's on the script. When there's words are coming off there that aren't written, it forces the actors to listen. And when we're listening, that's whenever we see the greatest truth that we can see on film.
Us actors are used to sort of creating backstories or at least, wanting some information about our character. How much did you work with how much of your characters were what was in your script already, and how much did you work with like Willa and Dermot and Shane to create, sort of flesh out the characters, if you will?
Well, each one was kind of different. I really didn't have to create anything else for Shane or Dermot in the two roles that I wrote for them, because it was all there on the page of why his character of Dion is doing, what he's doing, and why he's on the run. And with Dermot, it's just a powerful role of a man that owns everything in a small town and everybody works for him. Willa, I think, created a lot of her own backstory, and she didn't share her process, but I was very impressed with it. A lot of Willa's first takes is what I used in the edits. Like she had an idea of who this character was, and she knew exactly how she wanted to actually portray it.
Films, I think, in small towns are in a way, I think, more exciting than films set in cities.
I agree.
Why do you think that is? Is there something about
it's relatability.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's relatability. I think that 90% of the United States and probably 90% of the world is rural. It's rural, small town. And, I grew up watching movies where the actors were from L.A. or New York, and I didn't relate to them. I mean, I don't know what it's like to grow up in that place, but I do know what it's like to grow up in a place that is very small town where everybody knows everybody's business. And that's what I wanted to make a film about, was just how much and how different people are in small towns than they are in big cities.
There definitely is that sense of camaraderie because everyone does know each other, but is there also a greater chance of it leading to conflict because it is so small?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like that's the beauty of it, is because everybody knows everybody, everybody knows everybody's business. And if everybody's in your business, like you're just a recipe for conflict. There is, that's the beauty of it. It's like everybody knows everybody, and also everybody hides everything from everybody too.
You mentioned Shane and Dermot, and you said the characters that you wrote for them. So were they the two actors that you had in mind while writing the script, or how did that casting process come about?
You know, neither one were two that I had in mind while writing the script. My mentor once told me to never put myself in a box like that. So I tried to avoid just going, you know, writing for one specific actor. I knew that out of our list of possible Jeb Roys, I knew that Dermot was the one that I wanted the most. I think he's one of the best supporting actors that we have today. I think that we've seen him always play the good guy and the sweetheart, but to see him as a villain was truly, it was different. But I also knew that this was a role it's exactly what I knew it's what he was looking for as well. With Shane, the character of Dion, in the first probably 15 versions of the script, Dion was in his 20s. And when we started to realize in the casting process that we're not really finding somebody because it's just, we're missing. This is supposed to be a very brooding, very charismatic character that's got a lot of, you know, he's just got a ton of secrets. And one of the things that I started to consider is like, well, maybe he should be a few years older. And on the very first time that I changed the script that he's no longer 29 and he's like in his like late 30s, early 40s, we offered Shane West. And Shane West jumped right on board.
You know, it's funny. This is the second film I've seen in 2 days with Shane in it. And the other one he plays, it's also in a small town, but he plays a cop investigating the murders. So I kind of just laughed a little bit at that dichotomy. But I mean, that's acting, right? That's what great actors do, is they're able to, you know, this film deals a lot with the relationship of, you know, fathers and daughters and fathers and son and family. And obviously you grew up in small town Louisiana, but in terms of familial relations, how much were you able to draw from your own life into this?
Well, I am the youngest of three brothers, so no sisters whatsoever. And I was lucky enough to have both parents at home. I was very close. My greatest friends growing up was not as lucky as I was to actually have both parents at home. And the parent that they had was a little not sober most of the time. And so it was something that I've witnessed. I've seen it. I've lived this, but I have not personally lived it. I've just lived it as a friend. But no matter what, it's like these are, you know, where I'm from, the average income is $15,000 a year. Right. And there is, I've seen what people will do for the ones that they love, because getting money is not an easy thing to do if you're not on the right side of the track down there.
You know, obviously one of the characters in the film is a bit of an alcoholic and a junkie. And if, I mean, that exists everywhere, no matter if you're in, you know, a city or if you're in, you know, Africa, Europe or wherever. But it strikes me that social issues like that can get a little bit exacerbated, perhaps in smaller communities where everyone knows everyone's business. And, you know, it can lead to some tension. How, you know, in writing a story or even having lived it, how do you navigate something like that?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
If you have, you know, social problems can get exacerbated in small towns, and because everyone knows everybody's business, how would, if you knew somebody in that community who was going through it, how would you suppose you would navigate that?
Got you. I, you know, personally for me is like, it's just to navigate somebody that is more or less of an addict in a small town. You know, it's way easy. And I do believe it is easier to be an addict in a small town because of, you know, a lot of addiction comes from boredom. And it comes from having too much time on your hands. And that's one thing you certainly have in a small town. You know, there's a lack of things to do. There is, and how like to navigate that is usually, I mean, it's our families are really, really good about telling us whenever we're messing up. And, you know, that's the one thing about family is that's at least Southern families is, you know, when the shit really hits the fan, family's going to have your back. They will always be there. They will. That's the people that you can always count on.
So we always hear of the sort of the ideals of Southern hospitality. That's very, very, very much a thing.
Oh, it's very much a thing. So 3 days before we started shooting, my script was supposed to be a summer movie. And 3 days before we started shooting, the weather dropped to like 29 degrees. And so it was freezing, and we had people bringing us heaters. We had people bringing us, you know, jackets, coats. Every location that we used was for free. Every boat, every truck, every tractor. And we even produced a 380-pound hog in a day's time. And so, like, when I tell you, the Southern hospitality is so real that I just flew back a few days ago to premiere it in this town, and we sold out with less than a week. That people here have been so supportive of us just because of they know that I'm one of theirs and they want to see me succeed. And that's the best part of where I'm from.
Does this inspire you to shoot your future projects here, or would you like to make something that doesn't take place from where you grew up?
Well, I think in the near future, I would like to actually make another one. I've been writing, and I'm close to finishing a first draft of a new holiday thriller it's called Christmas Eve, but I've also based it in the Louisiana area because one, it's just, I know that I can produce it so well here. But it's definitely not what I want to do forever. I do want to explore the different, you know, different places and actually tell different stories that are not just, you know, small town Southern people. I think that I will always write for the small town, but I'm not sure if I will always do it for Louisiana.
Is there a certain identity that comes with being from a small town and a certain identity that comes from being Southern, or at least artistically?
Man, that's a great question. An identity from a small town is, you know, a lot of people from a small town, like we are a little bit shy when it comes to speaking up when you're out of your comfort zone, when you're in a place where there's a lot of people. It's just something we all have to get over. And Southern, I couldn't beat that out of me, and nobody could if they tried. There is an accent that comes with it. Whether we want to be or not, we're going to be kind. And we are going to always, another crazy thing is we always finish our plate. That's why the majority of the South is so damn big, but that's part of just the Southern heritage. We raise nice people. We raise people to say yes, ma'am, and no, sir. And we value respect a lot.
Speaking of finishing your plate, what is the best Cajun food?
Oh man, etouffee. Crawfish etouffee is the best food you will ever have in your life.
Etouffee, is that like a stew type of thing?
It's kind of like a stew. It's actually over a bed of rice, but it looks like a gravy that you pour on top of this rice, but it's got crawfish in it. It's got some shrimp tails. It's got all the good stuff that you can imagine, but it's just a creamy thing of just goodness.
All right. Well, further down in Louisiana, crawfish etouffee it is, right?
That's it, man.
In the course of shooting this film, what were there maybe one or two favorite moments that you had, or you know, maybe a day that stood out to you?
Yeah, favorite moments. And there's a favorite moment, I'll never forget it, but it was Dermot Maroney's first day on set. You know, it's everybody, cast, crew, everybody knew when Dermot Maroney was showing up on set. And everybody was on point. They worked as fast as they could that day. I've never seen a more perfect team than we did in that day. But that was just one of the many, many moments that we actually had together. I really was blessed with an incredible crew that worked as hard as they could.
You know, having this film as sort of your first like major project behind the camera, what does it do for you and your film when you get somebody like Dermot involved?
It brings all of the energy up. When it also confirms it to it, in my case, it confirmed it to me that this is very real. This is a man that I grew up watching on the television. And, you know, it confirmed that it wasn't just real. It confirmed to me that we have something good here. We have something that is going to, you know, attract a face that's going to be on the cover of your film. And whenever it's you, me, or whoever that are sitting down at night watching Netflix or Amazon or Hulu, we're going to most of the time stop on a face that we recognize. And getting Dermot Mulroney was, and Shane West and Willa Holland, like I could not be more ecstatic with the characters we got.
How does it feel that you're the one doing the interviews rather than them? Because so often, you know, it's the stars, it's the people in front of the camera that get paraded out on talk shows, you know, unless you're like a Tarantino or a Scorsese. But how does that aspect of feel to it? Because I can't imagine it's a hugely familiar experience for you.
It's definitely not. Like this is a first time experience for me, and I was not expecting this either. I was not expecting for anybody to want to know what's, you know, the writer director has to say with it. But it has been an incredible, you know, incredible, not only to, you know, for me, but I do think for like some listeners, it's like, it's, this is the ability to actually to start putting this stuff in words and actually saying that like, this all really happened because of three creative people that just refused to quit. You know, and if that can actually reach anybody, just know there's like, if you start something, it's like you want to see it all the way through, just don't quit. I'm telling you.
Do you think shows and media should make more of an effort than to interview other, you know, members of the film team, whether it's like a composer or maybe, you know, a costumer, rather than just the people who are the face of that film?
I absolutely think that would be great. It's just, you know, so many people, if you're not in the industry, you don't know what, you know, the key grip is. You don't know what's the best, like, you don't know these things. It's like, and until you actually see somebody explaining what they do and how they did it, it's like, this is the only way we actually learn. And I think that it would be an incredible thing to actually like to show just, you know, the ensemble cast, you know, hear what they have to say from, because this could be their first film. What kind of experience did they take? What did they learn? It could be something from a, you know, producer standpoint. Producers are, I feel like we could all learn more about that. And it's one of the things that I feel like we'll never learn everything about.
Yeah. Even, you know, even if you work in the industry, you may not be familiar with the nuance of every single position, right? It's like, if you're an actor, like, I'm not going to know what, like, you know, the best boy or the lamp hop does or something, right? So, you know,
exactly.
more education is always better, right?
Always better, man.
And for you, sort of transitioning from an acting background, how different do you think your approach is to craft when you're behind the scenes rather than in front of it?
Oh, one of the things I'll say is like, there's a reason why I'm not an actor anymore. I don't really think that I was that great of an auditioner. And like, if you can't audition, it doesn't matter how good of an actor you are. So I found more comfort of being behind the camera, telling the story, being the artist that actually creates with all the artists. I like myself, like in my regular job, what I do, I'm a full-time artist and I paint murals and I paint everything. And I realized that this is the closest thing to painting, writing and directing. It's just like painting something. It is, you have a structure, you have a, you know, your brushes or your actors, they tell your story, and
Um, Do you think then you'll, like, will you always do in tandem? Like, will you always be a writer-director? Do you ever want to direct something that you don't write? Or, will, you know, are you ever willing to write something that somebody else can direct?
You know, I will always be a writer-director. This is just, this is the one of the things that brings me the most joy in life. It brings me the most stress in life and the most joy. And so I know that it is an absolute love of mine. I would be very open to directing somebody else's writing. I've never done that, but I love the just collective creativity that could actually bring. I don't think I would ever be an actor anymore unless I was absolutely perfect for the role, unless I was absolutely helping, you know, if I was really there to honor this director's vision. If I could not do that, I assume to stay behind the camera.
Well, the film is The Dirty South. And it comes out
November 10th.
November 10th, yes. That's next week already. I can't believe it's gone by so fast.
Man, trust me, me neither.
And that'll be in theaters on demand and digital on November the 10th. Matthew, thanks so much for your time today.
Dan, thank you, brother.
No worries. Cheers.
Have a good one.
And once again, that was my conversation with Matthew Yerby, the writer, director of The Dirty South. The Dirty South is in theaters on digital and on demand on November the 10th. That does it for me today. My thanks to Matthew Yerby and Nick Davis. See you next time. Bye for now.